We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good morning.
Good afternoon.
All right. Another.
We're trying to cover all the bases. Good evening.
Yeah.
Good night.
Starting out with Olympia and the state legislature.
It's been a while. Yeah, the state legislature hit an important deadline last week. That was the week in which legislation had to pass one or the other chamber, the House or the Senate, in order to advance. And the bills that did so will now go to the other chamber, and I'll talk about what's next in a minute. First, let me talk a little bit about some of the legislation that did not advance that was maybe somewhat surprising. A highly touted recycling bill called the WRAP Act, W-R-A-P, did not make it. That would have given more financial support for different types of recycling. This is a very green bill, and it did not make it. Rent control, of course, did not make it, as usual. It gets introduced every session, and it fails every session. But people thought it might have a chance this year. So that was unfortunate. The next step for the legislature in the next couple of weeks, they will get a revenue forecast. Remember, this is a long session. It's 120 days, so it will go until late April. And this year, the legislature is tasked with having to produce a budget for the next 2 years. That is based on the state's revenue forecast, and a couple weeks after that, the parties in the House and the Senate, both of which are controlled by Democrats, will produce a proposed budget. They'll pass it with amendments. They'll reconcile it between the two, and then it'll go to Governor Inslee, who may or may not sign it, all of it. With that in mind, some of the things that did pass and are going to advance in the next week or two, they'll start to have committee hearings for these. A bill that will reduce or rather restrict new natural gas connections for like new homes or businesses. The idea being to discourage natural gas use and thus all the fracking, the environmentally destructive practices that are happening in the Dakotas and up in the tar sands in Alberta and all the other places where that's taking place. That is a relatively positive development. It also undermines the effort of some utilities in Washington State to bring in more liquid natural gas, which has got all kinds of environmental and safety issues. So that was positive. This is kind of shocking. There was an assault weapons ban that has passed, I believe, the House and is now going to the Senate. That bill has been criticized by Republicans as being very poorly and broadly written. And, of course, it would face an immediate court challenge that's probably being lined up as we speak. But it is the first major gun restriction legislation that has passed in Olympia in many years. So that's encouraging.
Okay, and that's HB 1240 called Establishing Firearms-Related Safety Measures. And it's up for – its hearing is coming up this coming Thursday, March 23rd.
And what committee will that be in?
You know, I don't see that. Oh, it's a hearing in the Senate Committee on Law and Justice.
Okay. So that's coming up. So if you have an opinion on that bill, and I suspect a majority of our listeners do, let your state senator know, and particularly if he's a member, he or she is a member of that committee. The state legislative website has a lot of bells and whistles that make it easy to either watch hearings or offer public comment or testimony. but you can go to www.leg.wa.gov. I'm not going to sing it because I couldn't possibly do justice the way Maria does. So that's coming up. There was both chambers passed versions of a wealth tax bill. So that has to be reconciled between the two chambers now. And that, again, is going to depend a lot. What the fate of that bill is going to depend a lot on the revenue forecast by the state. So we'll keep an eye for when that comes down in the next week or two. A bill that was bipartisan, unfortunately, establishes a new class of crime called a gross misdemeanor. And that is being carved out specifically for various drug possession laws. That seems to me to be a step in the wrong direction, but Republicans were very excited by it. The Democrats compromised on it, and the compromise was that it will also funnel a lot more money into substance abuse treatment programs, which is a good thing. But throwing people in jail is a very bad way to treat substance abuse issues. Which, you know, the war on drugs has demonstrated over the last 4 years. And it's a very expensive way to not treat those issues. So that hopefully will not advance, my personal opinion. But the state website for legislation. You can see all the different legislation that is now being considered by one or the other or both chambers, and what committee it's in and what time the hearings are and all that good stuff. You can actually read the text of the bill if you're so inclined. www.leg.wa.gov. Were there any other bills that caught your eye?
I'm just perusing the list of Faith Action Network. There's several bills that are coming up for discussion this week that appear intriguing. HB 1579 for an independent prosecutor would create a state office to ensure fair and transparent prosecutions of police misconduct. The bill is scheduled for public hearing in the Senate Committee on Law and Justice on Monday. So that's
okay. So it passed the House already.
I believe so.
Yes.
Also, House Bill 1177 on missing and murdered Indigenous women and persons cold case unit would create a cold case investigations unit with the Attorney General's office. Bill is scheduled for public hearing in the same Senate Committee on Law and Justice on Monday. So that's one to keep an eye on. House Bill 1329, extreme heat utility shutoff moratorium, would prohibit utility providers from disconnecting electric or water services during extreme heat.
How is extreme heat defined?
That's a good question. That's not included in the update, but it seems like a no-brainer that, you know, in extreme heat or extreme cold, that's not a time to be, like, kicking people off the grid. So
yeah, you would think so.
That's scheduled for public hearing on Tuesday. HB 1559, Hunger Free Campus, would establish a benefits navigator program at institutions of higher education, university campuses, and tribal institutions to help students get support for basic needs. In a recent United Way of King County pilot initiative, students who received support services were 25% more likely to persist to the next term and complete a credential than those who did not receive services. So
that makes a lot of intuitive sense. I mean, if you're so stressed about finances that you're not eating properly, then you're more likely to, you know, drop out and find a job or, you know, stop because you're working two jobs already. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And there's a phenomenal, I mean, I can't remember what it is for higher education, but just amongst grades K through 12 in Washington State, there's a phenomenally high percentage of people who are homeless that are going to school. You know?
Yeah. For Seattle public schools, the figure is something like 20%. It's astonishing.
And then finally, one more, HB 1143, require a permit to purchase firearms, would require safety training, a 10-day waiting period, and a comprehensive background check to purchase a firearm, reducing gun deaths and impulsive acts of violence. That is coming up on Thursday.
And of course, the gun lobby is mobilizing against that one, as well as the assault weapons ban.
Yeah. So, moving on, the Washington State Supreme Court.
They had a unanimous ruling this week on a case out of Snohomish County, and what they upheld was the right of public transit agencies to use essentially spot checks for fare enforcement. Now, this is something that that Sound Transit did on like Link Rail and on the Sounder trains and various other, you know, long distance buses that they operate until the pandemic. A lot of utilities suspended fare enforcement entirely during the first part of the pandemic. And when they began fare enforcement again, with Sound Transit, there was also the criticism, that had been levied over the last several years that there was racial inequities baked into the fare enforcement, that they were more likely to issue tickets to non-white riders. So now what they have is something called ambassadors, which don't issue a ticket. They issue a warning. They give you education about how you can pay your fare, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you are a repeat offender or a persistent violator, then they will ticket you. Now, the Snohomish County case was a little different because the person who brought the case was actually arrested for getting into it with Snohomish County Sheriff's deputies who were actually doing the fare enforcement. They demanded his ID. He refused, saying he didn't have to give them ID. They arrested him and took him off the bus or whatever it was. I believe it was a bus. And so he sued, saying, I don't have to give you my ID. And in that case, he won. So the justices ruled that public agencies can use spot checks for fare enforcement. That was part of the lawsuit. But in the specific case of this young man from Snohomish County, they said no. He didn't have to give them his ID. He didn't have to cooperate with sheriff's deputies. He was never told that he could simply get off the bus and that would solve the problem. Without being arrested. He was not told that he could leave, in other words. So it was a mixed decision. Agencies like Sound Transit have that option for the future if they decide to go back to, fare enforcement and, transform their ambassadors into, law enforcement agents again.
And this becomes even more of a major issue as time goes on, because as we move towards, as you encourage more people to use public transit and you make it the backbone of your transportation system, this is going to have profound long-term effects on.
Yes. And, you know, the expansion of light rail is already happening. They're building out the rail systems. Both north of town, Northgate opened last year, and they're still constructing the line to Snohomish County, which I believe is supposed to open next year. And they're also working on construction for the line to the east side. So that is underway, and then there's further expansions that voters have already approved that are in various stages of planning. Going south past the airport to Federal Way and eventually Tacoma, and then north eventually to Everett. There's a line, I believe, that's been approved from West Seattle to Ballard, There's all sorts of, complicated, wheel lines. There'll be multiple lines as opposed to the one line that's open now. That's going to change in the next decade. And then, bus service hopefully will expand as well. And hopefully that'll all expand in a coordinated way. And then let's not talk about the trolley. that's kind of a mess right now.
All right. Well, moving on then, I guess, to national. Speaking of a mess, we spoke last week about Silicon Valley Bank. Did you manage to get all your money out in time, Joff?
I did. Actually, my money's in a credit union, so it was never imperiled. I highly recommend credit unions because they're not greedy-ass bankers. The fallout from the Silicon Valley collapse and the collapse of a couple of other banks continues. In particular, this week we saw First Republic Bank getting bailed out by the feds. When that bank, which had a huge stock drop when the market opened on Monday, and was sort of struggling all week, that finally got bailed out on Friday. And then Swiss regulators stepped in to help Credit Suisse, which is a huge international financial institution based in Switzerland. Now, you may not think that Switzerland regulates its banks very much, since it's a traditional, a haven for secrecy, but they actually do. And, it's a major industry in Switzerland because they're seen as an international tax haven, basically. Certainly banking haven for, people who don't want to see their finances looked at too closely. So, the fallout from the Silicon Valley Bank failure, has had international ripples, which seems kind of surprising until you realize how closely connected the network of international finance is. People don't just watch, the Wall Street or Wall Street and NASDAQ now. They also watch Hong Kong and Tokyo and Shanghai and London and Paris and Berlin and all these different, stock exchanges, where, you get real time reporting. So it's basically a 24/7 thing. It's all very interconnected now. The regulators in the United States are saying that they will bail out any bank that runs into additional troubles, and it seems like the stock market it makes efforts towards stabilizing, and then it keeps going down. It was consistently down all this week, so we're not out of the woods yet. Hopefully we will be by this time next week, but it's not a 2008 type bank run, but that and the rapid hiking of interest rates to try and stem off inflation look to be the main culprits in this. And this is something that both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been pointing out very loudly this week. The repeal of some of the Dodd-Frank measures, particularly the measures that require stress tests for any bank with more than $50 billion in assets, that got changed under Trump in 2018 to $250 billion. And that Silicon Valley, which had $200 billion in assets and was the 20th largest bank in the U.S., fell into that exception and actively lobbied for that repeal of Dodd-Frank, for those provisions of Dodd-Frank. So this is something where the bank said, no, don't regulate us, we'll be fine. And Congress, in its infinite wisdom, listened to the money rather than to history and common sense and said, okay, you're on your own. And that's why we're having these banks collapse. Now, aside from people who own stocks, the damage so far has been relatively limited. Where it will affect ordinary people more is if the U.S. government has to bail out a number of these banks, because the Biden administration has said, well, there's a fund for this and banks pay into the fund, and so we'll just charge the banks if more banks fail. Unfortunately, those banks will turn around and charge their customers. So, the days of $10 ATM fees are, possibly around the corner. That's where it might affect ordinary consumers, unless you happen to have deposits in one of these banks. Again, the government says it's fully gonna fully guarantee even beyond the FDIC insurance limit of $250,000. But if you have more than $250,000 in one of these banks, you probably don't need the help to begin with, but, that's just my opinion.
Moving on, it sounds like there might be some fresh news this week regarding our former president.
Yes, there's a lot of stuff going on around Donald Trump's legal troubles. Michael Cohen spent 2 days testifying to the Manhattan grand jury on Monday and Tuesday. And on Friday, the Manhattan DA's office started making public plans for security in case Donald Trump is indicted. And Donald Trump's lawyer said, yes, if he were indicted, he would actually show up in court. And Trump himself overnight put out a statement saying he expected to be arrested on Tuesday and calling on his supporters to, basically riot. He didn't use that word, but that's what he meant. He could be indicted as soon as Monday. This is in the Stormy Daniels case. And Daniels also came out publicly this week and said she would be willing to meet with she met, in fact, with the Manhattan DA. And would be happy to testify. People forget that there was actually another person involved in all this, and it was a person who had an affair with Donald Trump, which calls her judgment maybe into question. But she was the beneficiary of a very large payout to keep her quiet during the 2016 presidential election. And the question was that a campaign expense? Cohen certainly, who is Trump's fixer at the time, as well as his attorney, Cohen has certainly said publicly that it was. It was directly related to campaign hush money. And don't forget there was another woman named Karen McDougal, a former Playboy bunny, who Trump also had an affair with and who Trump also paid off in the 2016 election. And that whole thing was a conspiracy because it involved an agreement by the publisher of the National Enquirer to buy and then quash stories involving those two women or the affairs they might have had with Donald Trump. So it was pretty dirty all the way around. But it looks like that may be the first of the investigations into Donald Trump that may result in an indictment. We're also keeping an eye on Fulton County, which is Metro Atlanta in Georgia, where a grand jury has handed its recommendations to the prosecutor. The grand jury forewoman said they did recommend indictments of several people. That is the case in which Trump pressured the Georgia Secretary of State to find him votes in the aftermath of the 2020 election. And there's a couple different federal investigations, one of the January 6th riots and the other of the secret documents that Trump had squirreled away in Mar-a-Lago. There were some developments in those investigations this week also. Judge ruled on Friday that Woodruff's lawyers in the documents case can be compelled to testify, which is highly unusual because usually there's something called attorney-client privilege, but that doesn't apply if it's done in the commission of a crime. And apparently a judge agreed that there was enough evidence of a potential crime there involving the attorney that the attorney can be compelled to testify. Now, the attorney may just turn around and say, I plead the fifth to everything, but it does tell you that they're getting kind of high on the food chain in the documents case. Remember, in that particular case, there were to a different court representations by Trump's attorneys in June of last year that, we gave all the documents back, and then the raid in August found a bunch more documents, and then there have been more documents turned over since then. So that's an ongoing saga. And that is materially different from the secret documents case involving both Joe Biden and Mike Pence, because in both cases, Pence and Biden, they cooperated with authorities. They allowed searches of their properties. The searches turned up some documents, some stray documents, not nearly in the kind of numbers of boxes and boxes of them that Trump had squirreled away. And, you know, the offices of the president and the former vice president have been fully cooperative with those probes. Trump, not so much. Took a year and a half before the raid of negotiations with first the National Archives and then Department of Justice. And, you know, Trump, for whatever reason, just wouldn't give them up, even though he seemed to have believed that they were rightfully his because he was still rightfully president or something. That is that's the update in Trump world, and hopefully we'll be talking about an indictment this time next week.
All right.
I live in hope.
I can't hold my breath for that long.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Finally, just enough time to squeeze in the International Criminal Court.
Yes, the International Criminal Court this week issued yesterday, I believe it was, Europe time, issued an indictment of Vladimir Putin for war crimes. Now, this may seem like a no-brainer, but what was interesting that they didn't do it for the numerous documented war crimes that have been happening over the last year in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is itself illegal under international law. They didn't do it, for instance, for the massacres in Bucha in suburban Kiev early in the invasion. They didn't do it for the saturation bombing of civilian targets that happened in Mariupol and various other cities where civilians were clearly targeted. They did it for the kidnapping of Ukrainian children, which is an issue that has not gotten nearly as much attention in U.S. media as those other two. But in Russian occupied portions of eastern and southern Ukraine over the course of the last year, they have been shipping Ukrainian children out, not with their parents, just the kids, and giving them to foster families in Russia. It is a systematic depopulation that's really genocidal in its intent. And it's something that, again, U.S. media has not been covering because it's not as interesting to cover as rubble or something like that. But it really underscores how the priorities of an institution like the ICC are very different from U.S. media priorities when it comes to coverage of that war, even though it's a war the U.S. is very heavily involved in. It'll be interesting to see if there are additional indictments from the ICC. Of course, the chances that Putin is ever going to be put on trial for any of this are vanishingly small. He virtually never leaves Russia now, unless it's to, you know, friendly client states. Where it might have an impact on Putin is freezing of international assets, which Putin largely has under other people's names anyway. By a number of estimations, he is actually the richest man in the world, even though none of it is in his name. Because, you know, as is typical for corrupt autocratic heads of state, you know, he gets a quick cut in all the corruption below him and all the oligarchs that are dependent on him for their approval and their wealth. They funnel some of that money back to him, and, you know, you got a few dozen of those, and it adds up very quickly. That money is going to be harder to move around now, but yeah, he's not going to stand trial.
Okay, that's about all we have time for this week, but...
There'll be more next week.
There inevitably will. All right, we will talk with you then.
Sounds good.